Back for part three. Thank you. It thrills me when I hear someone say that because this is exciting to me, these things. And there's always more things that are being discovered. As we were just talking a few minutes ago during the break about the Dead Sea Scrolls. Of course, I was learning other things since then. And everything that gets discovered can only prove further and confirm, let's put it that way, confirm further our faith. We looked earlier at the evidence that directly related to Jesus Christ, right? It was relating directly to him, man, that he was a real person who lived in the first century, he was buried, and that he died of that horrible reputation-destroying death. And we saw how critics try to explain away the hundreds of people who claim to have seen Jesus alive. But we also did read about scholars, and just a couple, too. There's many more that recognize the evidence that's there to confirm these things that we're looking at today. Strong evidence that appears to be in favor of the resurrection. We didn't prove the resurrection yet. Actually, you can't. Don't leave. Don't be disappointed. The title says proving the resurrection. Let me put a little qualifier on that. You can't prove a supernatural event that happened 2,000 years ago. Scientifically, you can't do that. But you can confirm there's enough information to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that it happened. Just like you could in a court case. You everyone here ever served jury duty? I had the honor of doing it on a couple of occasions. And you're never at the event when it happens. If you were at the event that it happened, you're disqualified. You can't come on the jury. But yet they're expecting you to come up with a solution at the end of all of the case evidence being presented. They want you to come up with a confirmation that you're sure that it happened. And you have to be sure that it happened if it's a murder case, because what you're determining is the life and death of that person, whether it's, death row for him or the rest of his life in jail. Well, how are you going to make that decision? You weren't there. Evidence. And when you look at the evidence that's presented and you're honest with it and you look at it, you come to a conclusion. Yeah, I know that happened. I wasn't there. But I'm sure. I can be sure it happened. And we're doing the same thing here. I'm going to be looking. That information we looked at was information directly relating to the man Jesus. But we're going to be looking at something about information that's not directly at the resurrection, but at events surrounding that time period. And we're going to see if those events that are historically, scientifically proven, because we got hard evidence for it, it happened, it's there, witnesses, et cetera, not Bible witnesses, I'm talking about secular history. We can then be sure, yeah, that's real, that happened. And looking at all that evidence, and what conclusions can we come to? And that's what we're going to do. Lesson three and part four and five tomorrow. I want you to keep something in mind. I've been saying it a number of times, I'm going to say it again. Many people today believe that Christianity evolved over hundreds of years. It was made up. It was invented. For whatever reason, you can come up with different ideas, and that it was embellished over hundreds and hundreds of years. And they just kept adding until you get what you got today. Just tuck that away. That's a big part of this discussion. We're going to be looking at historical events surrounding the resurrection. Not the resurrection things surrounding that time period. And as we do, you're going to find something very strange. Something very strange and interesting happened in the middle of the first century. I know, Drew, you're saying the resurrection. No, I'm not talking about the resurrection. We're going to be looking at something else, other things. And you're going to see something very strange happening in the middle of the first century. And you're going to have to think it's strange if you're a non-believer. We're looking at this through a non-believer's eye. Very soon after his death, as if out of nowhere, something happened. Something emerged. No, I'm not talking about the resurrection. We're not there. I'm talking about something else. A brand new, totally different religion. Completely different. A movement. No, it wasn't a religion. It's a movement that exploded on the world stage. It wasn't political. I gave it away. It was religious. Unlike any other religion. Was the world religious in those days? Very religious. Man has always been religious. They were very religious in the first century. But this movement is unlike any other in the history of mankind. And as we know, it started in this little tucked away place on the right side of that sea called Mediterranean. Is that the Mediterranean Sea? Over there in Judea. Now what? I want to stress, this is important. This is important. Because this is what makes it so strange. Did the movement start before Jesus died? No. It started after he died. That's one of the things that makes this so strange. Didn't it? No, it started before his crucifixion. No, it did not. And not only did it seem to explode out of nowhere after this man's death, what makes it even more strange, it exploded and survived against all odds. Okay, I know. Wait a minute. This flies in the face of reality, you're probably thinking. Well, before you think I'm crazy, bear me out. Let's look at some evidence, some basic evidence we're going to start with, that leads me to this conclusion. And it's not just from one source. We've got a couple of sources. You ever hear of Cornelius? No, not the one written in the Bible. Cornelius Tacitus. You might have heard of him. A Roman orator. In fact, he was a senator, Roman senator. He's recognized as a great historian. And I don't know if you've ever read the book, but first of all, he was born in 56 A.D. and died in 120 A.D. Puts him right in the middle of what I call the sweet spot. The middle of the first, the end of the first century, and into the second. He's recognized as a great historian by modern historians and secular scholars because he wrote a book called The Annals of Rome. Imperial Rome, I might add. Yeah, The Annals of Imperial Rome. You ever hear this guy? Yeah, some of you have, yeah. In that book, one of the things he wrote about was the Great Fire. What fire was that? The Great Fire, referred to as the Six-Day Fire of Rome, happened in 64. No, Ed, not 1964. 64 A.D. Ed and I relate to 1964. But 64 A.D., the Six-Day Fire, it broke out. Where was Nero? Nero was the Roman emperor at the time, right? Where was he when that fire broke out? Nero was 35 miles away in his private place in Antrium, away from Rome. And after the fire, he returns to Rome and he begins a great relief effort. He wants to give relief to the homeless. A lot of people lost their homes in this fire. And Tacitus describes how he wanted to rebuild the devastated city. He's the leader. He's the emperor. But you know, they didn't trust Nero. People didn't trust Nero. In fact, some of them thought, you know what? I think this guy started the fire. And we have some of that. I don't know if that's a fact or just a rumor, but at least in that day, it was a rumor going around that Nero started the fire. One of the things that made him look so suspicious was all the land that was destroyed and he's building up. Well, some prime land was destroyed. And you know what he put there? His personal palace. Yeah. That was very convenient that the fire destroyed that area, but that's what he did. And that gave them suspicion about him being responsible for the fire. So what's a corrupt politician to do? I mean, when you've got people pointing fingers at you and starting rumors, what's the first thing you got to do? You divert attention away from yourself and you point fingers. You point fingers at somebody else and you blame them. So who better than blame? You foolish Christians. That's who he blamed. Nero accused those pesky little Christians of starting the fire. And that's when he began severely persecuting Christians. First time. This is the major event of Roman authorities persecuting Christians. Before that, it was primarily the Jewish community and some local politicians, but this was a turning point. How do I know all this? Because you can read it in Tacitus' book. Here's a quote. Consequently, to get rid of the rumor, get rid of the report, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty, in other words, crucifixion, during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilatus. Recognize those names? Tacitus is clearly identifying the origin of this movement to a man called Christus, Christ. And he documents that Christ was actually executed by Pontius Pilate under the reign of Tiberius. Did he get that from the Gospels? No, he did not. He's not a friend of Christianity. He's writing history, secular history, just like modern historians write today. And that's what he's doing. He goes on to say, in a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment, again broke out not only in Judea, the first source of this evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. Didn't know you were in an evil or among evil people, considered evil. Most mischievous superstition, you guys believe, started over there in Judea, ended up here in Rome. Okay, what's the point? How long did it take that to happen? How long did it take for this movement, which was checked for a while, but then it sprung up over here in Judea again, and ended up all the way here in Rome, more than halfway across the Mediterranean? How many years did that take? 300-400 years? Do the math. Let's see, if we put Jesus dying around 33, and he's writing about a story in 64... 34 years? 30 years? Yeah, 31 years? That's an astounding fact. We're going to talk more about that in a minute. But let's continue with this quote. Accordingly, an arrest was first made of all who pleaded guilty. Then upon their information, an immense multitude was convicted, not so much of the crime of firing the city as a hatred against mankind. That moves me. Convicted of what? Against mankind. Mockery of every sort was added to their deaths. covered with the skins and beasts. They were torn by dogs and perished, or were nailed to crosses, or were doomed to the flames and burned to serve as a nightly illumination when daylight had expired. I mean, we've all heard things like this, right? Paul doesn't even describe, Peter doesn't even describe this detail of the of the persecution that they're going to go through. Tacitus is telling, writing history. He's not sad this is happening, he's just writing it as a matter of fact. Oh, but he does call us evil people. He doesn't like us. We're mischievous. The superstition is mischievous. We're evil. We're guilty of crimes against humanity. You deserve to die. We're no longer in 2018. We're in the first century. Put your mind where they're at, what they're facing. Not only does it corroborate these things, that Jesus lived, he was crucified, and the movement was based on his name, but he acknowledges that soon after his death, the movement erupted, starting in Judea. Very quickly. Now, he doesn't say, on my calendar, it's 30 years. No, we do the math and we come up with that, about 30 years. He doesn't say that this movement began in Nirvana, some mystical, faraway land that you can't ever go to. No, in Judea. He names the place where it came from, where it started. Judea. And you know it's a real place. There's real people that live there. There's a real burial site that's there too, by the way, that this man was buried in. And so you could go do, if you mean, if you're really serious, you could go and travel and visit people to confirm some of these things. Real people in real places, starting in Judea. Can it be all tracked and verified? No one questioned him. This was a matter of fact. Verification. Yeah, Paul used verification, right? Paul used verifications more than, he didn't say 530. He says more than 500, right? 500 witnesses saw him. He verifies the resurrection based on that. Okay, that's Paul. Now, Tacitus is not talking about verification in that sense that you can go look at the witnesses, but he is telling us things that happened. A man that is an enemy of the movement, telling in his history book about this people, this group. Christians are evil. I can't stress that enough. That is not just the one-off. That's not just the flavor of the day. This is what they faced. This is the world they lived in, that Christians are evil. And when you document history or statements and make statements like that, and you get these from enemies of Christ in the middle of the first century, then you can, you know, you can put your, hang your hat on. This is legitimate stuff. This is not fake news. This is not made up. This is an enemy of Christ confirming things. Not made up over hundreds of years. In the very first century, it got to the size that Tacitus talks about, all the way over here. And that's the key point. Critics of the Bible try to tell us that this movement was slow and evolved and invented. Stories embellished over hundreds and hundreds of years. Why? Well, we don't know why. Selfish gain, controlling people. It was not invented. The movement was an explosion in the first century. And the way it grew was unparalleled by any other movement prior to that or since. Now, we've got movements in our world always flying up and coming up, but none of them grew like this one did, starting in the first century. And it's all, we have facts. That's just Tacitus. We have a lot of people that are not disagreeing with that. In fact, are confirming that. What could have caused it? What could be responsible to cause this movement, this unprecedented explosion, unparalleled movement, to not only start, but to grow? One answer I can come up with, I think there's a simple answer to this. And I'm always looking for simple answers. I don't like complicated answers. The knowledge of Jesus Christ. That's what did it. I thought when he's going to say, wouldn't it be the resurrection? Yeah, for us Christians. But I'm a non-believer. Resurrection didn't happen. That movement happened. That movement blew up, exploded, came on, and what could be doing that? It was the resurrection. It had to be the knowledge of Jesus Christ then, because that's what it's about. That's what Tacitus said. It's about this man Jesus. So it had to be about the knowledge of Jesus Christ that caused this to happen. So if any of you are non-believers, let me just say, it wasn't the alleged resurrection. Believers know it was. But that's for the next story. It's the knowledge and his resurrection. Something caused this movement to spread throughout the entire Roman Empire in the first century. Witnessed by Tacitus and others, and something caused it. And we're going to look at it. Some of that stuff we're going to look at tomorrow, but we're going to look at some other stuff right now. Tacitus is not the only source. I'd like you to meet this fella, Lucian. Anybody hear Lucian? Samosata? Like Tacitus, Lucian also was not a friend of Christianity by any stretch of imagination. He was extremely sarcastic towards Christians. In fact, he considered them misfits. In fact, he's able to size you guys up. He knows about you guys. He recognized us. We're in the first century, and you're believers. And he recognized something very interesting about all of you. There's something common among you that's very interesting. In fact, it identifies you as a Christian. It's what makes you a Christian. It's why you're a Christian. This man recognizes something about us. Whoops, did I pass it up? Here he is. The Christians, you know, worship a man to this day, the distinguished personage who introduced their novel rites and was crucified on that account. You see, these misguided creatures start with the general conviction that they are immortal for all time, which explains the contempt of death and the voluntary self-devotion which are so common among them. He considers them misguided creatures. But notice what he says that's common among them. They start with a general conviction that they can live forever. Now, you and I don't find that unusual. We don't find that strange. But he notices it. They start with this idea of immortality, and he doesn't call it a belief. He calls it a conviction. Modern skeptics tell you today, you Christians, you become a Christian, and over time you're brainwashed, and eventually you're convinced that you have immortality. You think you're going to live forever and ever. I've heard that. You're brainwashed. You don't think that in the beginning. Look what Lucian says. He lived among them in the first century who had a conviction. They start with it. That's what they start with. The conviction that they're going to live forever. He finds that amazing. He finds that's what's common among all of them. And he uses the word conviction. This tells us a few things. His statements tell us that, he knows about Jesus Christ. He knows what happened to him. He knows that he was crucified. And he knows about those that follow the man. He's clearly not a Christian himself. He calls them misfits, right, or misguided creatures. But he does tell us about the force that drives them. That force that lets them go through the things we briefly talked about before that Tacitus talked about, the persecution. And he speaks about what that force is. In other words, the motivation, the attraction. What is it? Right? And the interesting detail that he gives is that this force, this whatever it is, he calls it this common thing among them, allows them to face torture and death at every turn without fear. I don't see that in myself. And I guess it's because I'm fortunate I'm not faced with that. I don't know what I'll do if I am. I pray that I will be like them and that I will face whatever comes. But I'm telling you, he saw that in them. The contempt of death, as he called it. Do you have contempt of death? I don't even know if I started thinking about that before I started this series of studies. Whew. Remember I told you before I get goosebumps, I get chills on some of the things? Well, this gives me the opposite, goosebumps and chills, because I don't know where I stand. I think I know where I stand, but I haven't have to prove it. You see, in the first 300 years of Christianity, it was risky business. You risked everything. Everything. Your family, your job, just because you become a Christian. And if it's without the resurrection, then it's only because of the knowledge. You see what I'm saying? It's the knowledge of Jesus Christ from a believer's, a non-believer's point of view. They became a Christian and risked everything because of the knowledge of Jesus Christ. It's a little weak. I think it's because what they knew about Christ. And we know what they knew about Christ. And we'll get to that. But to tell me that this thing evolved over hundreds of years, impossible, because for the first 300 years, you're getting killed. You're being squashed. These guys are telling us that. Lucian is telling us that. Tacitus is telling us. That's what modern day skeptics tell us. But these guys are painting a different picture, those that live there. He's amazed at how much they trust this man. Lucian was amazed how much they trust this man with their lives, allowing themselves to face the threat. Not just death, but this horrible death. You risked everything. For what? That's the society our brethren lived in the first century. That's the world they lived in from the top down. Everyone hated you. Everyone hated anything you stood for. Just like they hated Christ. They hated you. This is the world that the movement was born in. It faced unfavorable conditions. It was not supposed to survive. It was going against cultural, social, economical, political, everything. And you didn't gain anything from it. And so, it was against all odds that this thing even got off the ground, never mind explode on the scene. Christianity was born in this world, and it should have failed. It should have failed. How could this be? Roman Empire, they invented the most cruel, inhumane way of execution, that crucifixion. because it did more than just kill him. It ruined his reputation. It destroyed him. And we saw historical evidence of that. Second, for both the Jew and the Gentile in the first century, reversal of death was impossible. Resurrection was not an option. Wait a minute, I didn't talk about reversal of death too much. I have to confess, the material I have, it's 13 hours worth of material over 13, 14 weeks. And I had to bring it down to 5. Don, you can't, I mean, yeah, at that time I was talking with you, Don. We can't extend that? No. But I say all of that to say there's something, well, what do you cut out? There's a lot of material. Well, one of the things I left out was this reversal of death opportunity, mindset, worldview. I'll just briefly mention it. Reversal of death was an impossibility among the Greeks. Hey, I think it's an impossibility among us too. Yeah, exactly. Doesn't happen. You die, you go in the grave, you're coming out of that? No, it's impossible. Okay. So the physical reversal of death, that's not an option. It's impossible. Do you know? I'm sure you do. I'll remind you, but no. Christians didn't believe it either. Christians in the first century. No. You don't get raised from the dead. Oh, really? Paul was fighting that concept in the entire chapter 15 of 1 Corinthians. What do you mean Christ is not raised from the dead? How can you say there's no resurrection from the dead? That's what they're saying. There's no reversal of death, Paul. How could you say that? Because if you're saying that there's no reversal of death, no resurrection of the dead, then Christ was not raised. So you're thinking wrong, Christians. Really? There is reversal of... You see, that's the mindset of... I'm just saying that. He convinced them. It took some doing. You've got to give them hard facts. They had to do a lot of miracles. The mindset in that first century, no reversal of death. Impossible. And so... Oh, there it is there. If Christ is proclaimed as raised from the dead, how can some of you say that there is no resurrection of the dead? Some were saying that. 1 Corinthians 15. Whatever motivation, whatever reasons, wherever they were learning it, the consensus was, both among Christians and all the Greeks and Gentiles. Even the Jews didn't believe in resurrection, except the Pharisees, they did. The Sadducees, they didn't, right? Oh, yeah, they believed in the final resurrection. Everyone's going to be raised on that last day. But a physical resurrection, a personal resurrection? Mm-mm. That's the worldview. That's the mindset. No. There's no evidence of that. Yeah, Jesus, he was raised from the dead. But that doesn't really mean I am too, does it, Paul? Yes, it does. I'm just trying to say, the mindset was no reversal of death. So, that's the mindset. That's the worldview. And here comes this Jewish man who says, oh, let me tell you about the reversal of death. They're going to laugh him out of town. And they did. Some of them didn't. No. This thing should have failed. Everything was going against it. Reversal of death is impossible. Paul had to come down hard on the facts to show and convince them, even Christians. Point is, Christianity should have failed. Third, Christians were hated. Rome and its citizens. They were hated by everybody. You needed to be removed, Ty. Sorry, we're taking you off to jail. And if you don't renounce Christ, we're going to kill her. That's what you faced. I can't identify with that, can you? I live in a country. Where I can come from Pennsylvania without a passport into this state, New York, without a passport. I can't relate to what they were facing. And this is all documented by Tacitus and Lucian and others. So my point is, Christianity should have failed. Okay, that's what they said. But The question becomes, is there any evidence? And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to look at evidence that confirms and shows and proves things happen. Is there any evidence that misguided creatures who were willing to risk everything that I just talked about, did people like that really live and exist? Do we have records from that happening that collaborates what those two Romans said? Well, I wouldn't be asking the question if I had a no answer to that, would I? Of course I have evidence. I can point to martyrs like Polycarp and Justin Martyr, Ignatius, other Christians. These are Christian leaders who were persecuted. You can read about them. But I want to share with you a story of someone that's not so famous. The everyday, well, I would say the everyday person like us. Well, she's an everyday person. Was an everyday person, but there's something different about her than me. She was rich. I wasn't. I'm not. Have you ever heard of Perpetua? Anyone hear of Perpetua? Some of you may have heard of this woman, Perpetua. She was a young Christian lady, a noble woman, meaning wealthy, rich family, 20 years old. She had her whole life ahead of her. Pagan family. She died in Carthage around 200 AD at that tender age of 20. Oh, to be 20 again. Wow. She died at that age of 20. And the painting we see here, the painting wasn't painted then. It was painted several hundred years ago. But there's a painting from, well, we'll explain how we got this information. But the painting illustrates her story, her life, the things that she was going through. And you can see from this painting that there's people around her. And they're really not angry with her. They're not in her face. They're pleading with her. They're begging her. The young man next to her, extending his arm, is Hilarius. I can't say his Roman name. Hilarius. There we go. He's the governor, similar to Pontius Pilate, same office level. And he really doesn't want to kill her. He's pleading with her. Make the sacrifice to the gods. Honor Caesar. Make your sacrifice, and you can go home. You can go home free. Live your life. The old man sitting to her on her right, I'd be her father. He's saying, daughter, pity my gray hair. Don't do this. Give up your pride. Don't, please, please. He's pleading with her. Don't abandon me. The governor says, look at your younger sisters there. Listen to your relatives. Who's going to take care of them? Look at your father. What's going to happen to him after your death? I mean, he's threatening her, but he's begging her, don't go through this. Probably wouldn't give that much encouragement to change her mind if she was poor. You know, we didn't have money. She was from a noble family, so that could be why. I'm guessing on that one. I don't know why he's pleading with her, but we have this information. The other man on her right would be the official holding the document, the certificate, if you will, that you get once you make your sacrifice. You get a receipt, but you'd frame it, put it on your wall once you made the sacrifice to the Roman gods. But you see, to a Christian, this is not an option. She will not make the sacrifice. She's a Christian now, and it was unthinkable to do this. Maybe a year ago, but not now. She knows Jesus Christ. Another tidbit of information. No, it's more than a tidbit. While she was in prison, she gave birth to a baby. I think it's a boy. I think I read it was a boy, a son. And the governor says, Perpetua, think about your son. Who's going to take care of him? Do you realize this in the first century? Infanticide. No. How do you say that word? Infanticide. Was the way of the world. The baby's born, you don't like it, you throw him or her on the garbage heap. That's society. They didn't care. Perpetua, what are you going to do about your boy? Think of him. Just make the sacrifice. We know these things because it's written in her diary. That's what it says up there. The diary of Perpetua. They found this diary of this woman. And she could have freed herself. She could have simply said, okay, here's money. Let's go home. And then go back to being a Christian next Sunday. She didn't. She'd rather not mock Jesus Christ, her Lord. She could have saved her life. She could have saved her baby's life. She could have gone back to living this luxurious, comfortable lifestyle, a noble woman in this wealthy, rich family. But on that day, she chose something else. And she wasn't the only one. There's others. We know that because she gave her diary to another Christian, a fellow Christian in prison. And he made the final entries in her diary. And it included others that day. Let's read it. The day of their victory dawned, and they marched from prison to the amphitheater joyfully, as though they were going to heaven, with calm faces, trembling, if at all, with joy rather than fear. There it is. The contempt for death that Lucian recognized in every one of them. We're seeing it in the documentation that was discovered about her life. Most of the time, I mean all the time, Christians, well, I wouldn't say all the time, but most of the time Christians could, on trial, they could place their sacrifice for the idols and say, okay, I'll denounce Christ, I'll curse Christ, and go on their way. But most of them didn't do that. They didn't choose that. She didn't choose that. This we do know. She chose this. Nope, did I pass them slides up? No, I'm ahead of myself. This is what they chose. Yeah. Not one, not a few hundred, tens of thousands of human beings chose this, knowing where they were going in that Colosseum if they denied Caesar. All they had to do was deny Christ. Next time you read passages like this, Paul wrote, "O death, where is your victory? Where is your sting?" Gives me more meaning and understanding what he was talking about when I see people from history that have done this and faced this. You go against everything when you become a Christian in the first 300 years. Why? What would cause any of them to do that? Widespread pressure came upon you from every corner to push you to reject Jesus Christ, this man, this simple man, who didn't lift a finger of violence. That's the world they lived in. From the authorities, from the city you lived in, from the guild you worked with. You guys work, you women work? Well, you had to be in a guild to work a trade in first century Rome. And if you didn't honor the trade god, the guild god, you're out. Who wants you? You're going against everybody, including your own family, because of this man, Jesus. Because as a Christian, you can't afford to even acknowledge their gods. You see, Rome, this is interesting. Rome was a multicultural empire. They conquered many different lands, and they brought in people from all different cultures. And they all had their own different gods. And you could believe anything you want. You want to believe your God, fine. You want to believe your God, fine. Good, good. You can tolerate them all, whether it was the politics, whether it was the religious God that they're believing in, the philosophical ideologies. All you have to do is tolerate them. Christians can't do that. They felt they could not do that. They could not betray Jesus Christ and acknowledge that these other gods are real. As long as you are ready to acknowledge that they were real, you can believe anything you want. But no one would hurt you. But Christians wouldn't do that. And you know what they called you? Yeah, we know that they called them Christians. The populace called them Christians. But do you know what you were? You were an atheist. Because you didn't believe in the Roman gods. You denied the existence of the Roman gods, and you would follow Jesus. Why? Why would they do that and put themselves through that and risk everything, their very own lives, their very own children? Tens of thousands of them did that. For the first 3 centuries. You know when it stopped? This is a little side. You know when it stopped? I want to say Clementine. Was it Clementine? Constantine. 321. They made Christian religion legal. 321. It was illegal for the first 300 years to believe in Jesus Christ. You had your property taken away from you. You couldn't work in different places. You didn't own property. You couldn't do anything. And then you would be facing death. It evolved? No, it didn't evolve. It was solid year one, year two, year three. It was solid. Everything was established. So, as a non-believer, if the resurrection never happened, what could be the reason and the motivation for otherwise normal, everyday thinking people to go through that? My plea is to, my sincere question, an honest question to my non-believing friends is, please explain this dilemma. I can't. This needs an explanation. Christianity exists today. And everyone says, even the non-believers for 2,000 years, they may not like it, but it exists. And here's the conditions in which it was born in and what they faced. Please, I need an explanation. I used to be brain dead and didn't care. And a lot of people today don't care. I hope I can meet them, and if anyone's in the room here that's in that mindset, please, let's have a discussion. Because this needs an explanation. Whether you're a believer or non-believer, it needs an explanation. And so, that leads me to, could there be a natural explanation for all of that? Could there be something that actually allows that to happen that doesn't require a supernatural event? Because if there is an answer that can show that there's a natural cause to this, that would have an advantage, because that'd be a simple answer. Because the supernatural resurrection is not as an easy answer. It's a bit more complex. But if you can tell me there's an easy, natural answer, I'm all ears. Let's go. We're going to look at further implications of all this in our next lesson. We'll look at more historical evidence to see if there is something that can explain or give a natural cause for the phenomena. I was going to say, that's possible, but I can't even say that because I know what I know, and you know what I know, that I don't think there is. But from the non-believer's point of view, we're going to look at some possibilities, because there are some possibilities that people bring to the table. And we're going to look at them. And then we can really make some good decisions. Any questions? We're going to go into lesson, what, four tomorrow? Yeah, four and five tomorrow. Yeah.
Well, I was going to have a question. I was just amazed that the way the Christians were being treated, not only in Acts chapter 8, they were being they were being mistreated. And the scripture said they were scattered. They scattered everywhere, but they didn't scatter and go and hide. They were scattered and went preaching wherever they went. I did research on some of the things that happened to Christians. I mean, they used to put them on these tall poles and light them and dip them in oil and light them up so they could light the streets at night.
That's what Tacitus wrote. We read what he wrote. They illuminated the streets after the sun set with Christian bodies. We read it, but we can't identify with that. And I appreciate what you're saying. Yeah. What caused that? Okay, we talked about no such thing as mass hallucination. Is there any such thing as mass insanity? Yeah. No. Something else is going on here. And all I'm asking for is an open dialogue, a discussion. I want to talk to non-believers about that. And they'll just go so far and they... Well, that's what you think. No, I don't. That's not what I wanted to say. That's what I think. Show me. Any thoughts, questions? Yeah. They started going underground. Yeah. They would hide themselves during worship. Just before Constantine was the severe... This is not in the material, but it was in one of the lessons I cut out. Just before Constantine, I think it was Diocletian, emperor, in 301. Think this through. 300 years of trying to crush this movement. And what are they doing?
Makes it grow.
And the more they crushed. Right? Okay. I can't put this in his mouth, his words, but I'm saying, what's with these guys? Where do they get their strength from? What's going on here? Oh, wait a minute. They keep reading this document. These documents, they had scrolls there, right? That's it. In 301, he decreed throughout the empire, stormtroopers go to all of the towns and you grab their writings. And we burn them. They burn them. And if they don't want to burn them, then we burn them. And it's recorded that what he actually did was they would close the doors where they were worshiping, lock them up, set them afire. That's how bad. It wasn't just what you believed. Turn over the book you're reading. Hold on a second. I just want to add one more thing to that. And so here you are, right, in 301. The decree is made. And you know what they were reading? They were reading the books from Paul, a lot of books from Paul. They were reading Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, all of them, from Peter. They were reading Shepherd of Hermas. They were reading Clement, too. No, first Clement. Clement I. They were reading his letters. And they're reading Barnabas, the Epistle of Barnabas. And so you're reading these letters every Sunday and your Bible classes, and you're reading. That's what we do. We talk about them. We read them. And so when now the stormtroopers come in and say, okay, give us your books. We want your books. And they'd go, okay, let's see. Well, the Epistle of Barnabas. We know. We know that's not really inspired. Yeah, take that one. And they would, Paul, 1 Corinthians. No, can't have that one. This one, the Shepherd of Hamas. Yeah, you can take that one. They were giving out the books that were good to read and had benefit, but they knew by this time they weren't inspired writings. So we'll give them up, but we will not give these up. Do you know that's how we came up with the 27? I always thought it was the publisher that published the Bible. He came up with the 27. Because Paul never did. Paul didn't say, hey, here's the 27 books of the New Testament that you guys should be reading. That's no list. Well, how in the world did we end up with 27? Because the first century Christians did their due diligence to make sure this is so important, we're only going to read things authored or endorsed by the apostles. Everything else, no matter how nice Mr. Clement or Bishop Clement your letter is, it's not inspired. And he even said that. And so they would only then risk their lives for inspired writings that they knew were inspired. The rest, it's nice bullet, but I'm not going to die for those. I'll die for these. And that's what happened. And they went underground. People were starting to go underground with their worship and stuff like that. And a little off topic on how one of the things in the canon class that I teach, but that's what they were doing because the persecution reached that level. What you're reading is going to kill you. Yeah, what'd you want to say?
That's the reason why when you had your question was why didn't Jesus go to the unbelievers? Well, the unbelievers were the head of the multiple caste, just like you mentioned. When the miracle was performed, don't tell anyone.
My time's not here.
Right. So the same thing with that there. He went to the believers for this to explode, and it was the will of God also.
That's how it was to be done. Do you see now why also they needed the miraculous gifts to prove the message? Because the world is so hostile to such concepts. You just walk into a town and say, hey, yeah, let me tell you the story about a man who came from the dead. Get out of here. Right? And then he would produce miracles to show that he's from God. And then produce the evidence that Jesus was raised from the dead. And once you have the proof that Jesus was raised from the dead, everything else doesn't matter. Take my head off, because I'm not dying. That's the importance of that resurrection. Everything else in Christianity is great, but it's the resurrection that makes it. Without that, we're just a bunch of foolish people believing a lie that Paul said. Yeah, that's important. I can't stress that enough, how important understanding the resurrection happened. 1 Peter 1:21. I'm waiting for comments. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the key. The resurrection is our hope.
No, the resurrection is not hope.
With the resurrection of Jesus Christ, I can face whatever goes on tomorrow.
That's where you get your hope, because you believe it happened. I like to say, I know it happened. Because if I don't know it happened, then I can't believe in something else that I can't see. I can't believe in God. I can't see Him. If I know it didn't happen. If I don't know it happened. That's what Peter's saying. Unless I'm misinterpreting him. That's what Peter's saying. I'm not going there because it's in next lesson. I'm not going to the scripture to show you and talk to you about it now until next time. But This all needs an explanation. That's all I'm asking from my non-believing friends. Please help me with my dilemma. Any other thoughts? Questions? Yeah.
One of the things you can see about Christ is that there was a goal, as we said, in terms of age, like you had like BC before Christ and AD, right? So but the thing is that this whole like mankind had this division.
They put him at the center, don't they?
So if you look at any other religions, sometimes I ask guys, I say, show me another religion where
the world did that.
Yeah, the world put this person as like a divider.
You bring up another thought of mine. A lot of times people will say they don't want to use BC or AD after Christ, after death. That the Latin is... Yeah, it means after death. The year of the Lord. The year of the Lord. And so what do they do? What do they do now today? BCE, before Common Era. I don't have a problem with that. When was the start of the Common Era? Why that year, Mr. BCE? Why do you want to go to that year? It's still acknowledging the year of our Lord. You may not want to accept it, but you're doing it. The common era versus the previous not-so-common era started there. I think of that a lot. The world changed. We're going to look at some of those facts.
Who was the emperor?
I'm sorry?
Who was the emperor at the time, or who did it? The Greeks or the Romans?
Did what?
That.
Oh, that wasn't until what, 1200s, 1600s? When the calendar, they came up with that? I don't know. When was that?
Well, the year itself, I think in the 5th century.
The 5th century?
Somebody tried to figure it out, like, how many years ago Jesus...
Yeah, so in the 5th century, someone tried to figure out when Jesus was here.
But the monthly calendar,
that was a little off. Yeah, and that's interesting. Why would someone want to figure that out? Apparently, Jesus made an impact. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I know that Christ died, that he was buried, that he rose. And I know one day there's going to be a judgment. Now, how do we know? By faith. The Hebrew writer talks about that. Faith makes us understand what we don't know, but what we believe comes true because of what we believe. Now, we do that every day. I mean, you set the alarm clock, you're going to work. Now, you know you're going to get up on time. You know you're going to get to work. That's the moment the job is not there. It's not even in your mind. You know you're going to get up. You know you're going to get to work on time, and the job is going to be there. And that's what you call faith.
Yeah. But it's based on evidence.
Huh?
It's based on evidence.
Evidence.
There's certain things in the religion, in the movement, that's not based on evidence. Can't think of it right now. But God never expects us, or at least I can't find it in the scriptures, where he ever expected anyone to believe in him without evidence. Paul, Romans 1, the whole Gentile world is without excuse. Why? In Romans 1, because you see the universe. In other words, it's not just a mythical idea. You feel it, you see it, you touch it, you see the stars, you see the galaxies. They even knew about the constellations back then. I can't figure out how they did that. But anyway, they knew the universe. It doesn't come from nothing. And that's the struggle that evolutionists are facing today. They don't have an answer. Well, yeah, it doesn't. Nothing comes from nothing. But some are starting to say, yeah, it comes from nothing. It doesn't. But no, you're without excuse. You have evidence. The design, the patterns, the rules and the laws of nature and physics that we rely on every day. They don't come without a lawmaker. You got to have evidence. And then you can believe in someone you can't see, God. Any other thoughts? Questions? I'm really looking forward to tomorrow because